You are listening to the podcast of Providence Church in Austin, Texas. We hope this message raises your affections for Jesus and helps you live out the gospel in everyday life.
We've been walking through the Gospel of John, and clearly John's one point that he wants to just beat into the ground is Jesus is God. And he wants to show you that from every imaginable way that he can. And so in chapter 1, he kind of recreates the creation account to say that this Jesus came from God. And he says in there that he came as a light shining in the darkness. And then as we get to chapters 5 through 8, John does this really awesome thing. He begins to sort of reenact the Exodus story, which was the dominant redemptive story for the Jewish people. So at the end of chapter 5, you'll remember he's debating with the Pharisees, and he says to them, You have your faith in Moses, but if you really believed Moses, you would believe in me because Moses wrote about me. He makes this incredible claim. And then in chapters 6, 7, and 8, he goes on to illustrate what he means by that. And so just a quick survey. We have looked in chapter 6 where Jesus feeds the 5,000 and he says, I am the bread of life. And that points them back to when God provided manna in the wilderness. And he's saying that was just pointing to me. And we read how he walked on the water in that chapter, which points back to the great scene in which God has control over the Red Sea and splits the sea so the people might come out freely. In chapter 7, all deals with the people's muttering. And it's the same word that is used in the Exodus account about their murmuring and their complaining in the wilderness. And in their muttering, you begin to see they sort of rise up against Jesus, which is the same thing they did with Moses. They were opposing Moses, their leader. In the wilderness, right after they were opposing Moses, they're complaining because they're thirsty. Remember, Moses strikes the rock and water comes out of the rock. And Jesus, in the Feast of Booths, which is a celebration which reenacts that very thing, stands up and says, anyone who's thirsty, come to me and drink. I've got living water. When the people are wandering through the wilderness, they're traveling day and night. And so in the day, there's this pillar of cloud that leads them. And at night, there is a pillar of fire so that they can see where to go. And in chapter 8 of John, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. Some of their complaining in the wilderness is they begin to say, like, man, we would rather just go back to Egypt and be slaves. At least we were well fed. And in John 8, you have this great teaching from Jesus about what true freedom and slavery is all about. And they're always sort of reverting back to Moses, who gave them the law. And Jesus teaches them, if you abide in my word, you have true life. You're really my disciple if my word is in you. And so all of this imagery, John is showing us that Jesus is the long-awaited Messiah. He is the thing, the person that satisfies our deepest longings. Bread, water, and now in chapter 8 and 9, light. When Nehemiah looks back on the Exodus story, here's what he says in Nehemiah 9. He says, you led them by a pillar of fire in the night to light for them the way in which they should go. And again, Jesus picks that up in chapter 8 of John. I am the light of the world. Whoever follows me will not walk in darkness, but will have the light of life. All right, so light is one of the favorite themes of John. And there's a little bit of conflict to it. Because while it is great and illuminating, Jesus is in fact revealing who God is what John says. And so if you've lived with a preconceived notion of who God is, and that revelation is contrary to it, it's going to mess with your God categories. In the same way, if you've kind of learned to live in the darkness, like your eyes have adjusted and this seems like the way life is, and then the light of God comes and sheds light on the world around you and casts a different reality, then you're confronted with kind of your norm way of thinking. So there's some conflict to it. But what John is saying is that if we would look to Jesus, the light of the world, we would see true beauty, true wisdom, true life. He is the true God, become flesh. Did you guys ever have a kaleidoscope when you were a kid? In some sense, you could look at a kaleidoscope and be like, well, I mean, that's kind of cool. These little things spin on the end. If you don't know what to do with it, it's just like, eh, that's all right. It doesn't have much impact on your life. Some people responded to Jesus that way. Well, that's kind of cool. He walks on water. But it didn't impact them personally. With a kaleidoscope, there's just that little hole of light coming through. And if you will just get your focus right up on that light, you begin to see all the beauty of the lights inside of it. And in some ways, you could think of John's use of light in that way. If you would say, John was saying, if you would just focus on Jesus, look to him as the light of the world, you begin to see the true beauty of all that is around. You begin to see the world as he sees it. All right, so in chapter 8, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. And in chapter 9, John places this story here to illustrate what that means. And this kind of has two sides to it. One side is this. On the positive side, it's a parable, a living parable, about how God works in the world. On the negative side, you might say, it's also a tragic comedy about how the things that we think are really important often distract us from what is actually important. And so this story has something to say about God and something to say about us. You'll see as it unfolds, so let's just let's get into it. Verse 1. As Jesus passed by, he saw a man blind from birth, and his disciples asked him, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? So Jesus and his disciples are walking along, something they did often, and they see a beggar, which was also not uncommon. The scene depicts kind of just everyday life. But on this day, Jesus sees the beggar. He sees more than a beggar. He sees a man, a desperate man, a man in great need. And the disciples see him, but they only see him because Jesus sees them. In other words, they're only brought into the action of what's going on because they're with Jesus. And so Jesus is walking by. He sees the man and stops, and that forces them to stop and see. But you have to ask the question, and John is asking this question throughout, what do they see exactly? Of course they see a blind man, a beggar, on the surface of things, but their response reveals what they really see, like at a heart level. And that's going to happen throughout this story. There are the things that they physically see and the things that we physically, literally see, but John is always asking the deeper question, but what do you see really at a heart level? The disciples saw a theological question. Rabbi, okay, case study. Who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? It was a common belief in their time that there was a cause-effect relationship between sin and suffering. And while that's true kind of in a general sense, like suffering and brokenness exists in our world because of sin, because sin has entered the world, corrupted everything. Our reality is that we live in a fallen world. The mistake the disciples make is they're trying to take that general truth and apply it at the individual level. And so they are looking for particular sins that they could link to this instance of suffering. And that's just not how the world works. It's stranger than that and much more beautiful than that. This is their way of explaining suffering. It's their way of holding on to a belief that God is just. You know, so if I can explain this, if I can say, well, this is because of that, then I can see that justice. That all makes sense to me. If you suffer, you probably deserve to suffer. And if you prosper, you probably deserve to prosper. That's an equitable system that I can live with. We're not that different than them. Oftentimes when we suffer, we ask God, why me? Why is this happening? As if to say, what have I done to deserve this? Sometimes when we see the suffering of others, the thought crosses our mind, you know, they probably put themselves in that position. We don't say that out loud, but again, our lack of action reveals what we're really seeing at a heart level. Thinking that people basically get what they deserve, on one hand, is a crushing weight when things aren't going well for you, isn't it? And on the other hand, it's a convenient thing to believe when things are going well for you. And the disciples use this line of thinking to sort of excuse their inaction related to this blind man. That's how labels work. They've labeled this guy, just like we label people. We like to put people in categories, and very one-dimensional categories, by the way, because it excuses us, it precludes us from having to deal with the 4D complexity of what it means to be human. As long as we kind of got the thing wrapped up, bow on it, we've made our judgment, and now we can just stand at a distance and have a theological discussion about it. Some of our labels, we have so many. You might say, well, that he's just the intellectual type. I mean, he doesn't have feelings, so I can't really engage him. Or there's the hipster type. Why would you engage them? All they're thinking about is mustaches and cardigans. Why? They don't have real things to talk about, right? Or the emotional type. No, they're just so emotional. There's no need to engage them because they're just overreacting. Eventually, they'll settle down and, you know, everything will be fine. And so we just stand back. There's the lazy person, you know, to engage them only enables them. There's the draining person, which is clearly just not worth engaging at all. And so on and so on. The selfish, the introvert, the perfectionist. Can't you think of so many labels that you use for people around you that in some way give you excuse not to move toward them? The disciples had labeled this man. He was a sinner. That's why he's blind. Their seeing of this man doesn't cause them to move toward him. It only causes them to draw conclusions about him. It's a deep blindness. God is just, but his love and his justice doesn't work this way. It's not tit for tat. He's much more mysterious and glorious than that. And that's what we're going to see as the story continues. Verse 3. Jesus answered to their question, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it's day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I'm in the world, I am the light of the world." Okay, so when we label someone, we sort of lock them into that position, that label. We think of them as just that way. And it becomes hard to see them any other way, doesn't it? And so the disciples see this guy as something like a finished painting. Well, this is where he's at. It's probably what he deserves. Done. Let's just talk about it. Whereas Jesus is saying, look, what you see something that's unpleasant and that you want to turn away from. I see a canvas. I see an unfinished work. And I know it's black and gray and dark and chaotic, but that is actually the perfect backdrop for the light of God to shine forth. What you want to turn away from, I want to move toward. Because this is a backdrop against which the redemptive work of God can shine like a bright light for all who have eyes to see, to see. Having said these things, Jesus spit on the ground, verse 6, and he made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes, that is, he smeared the mud on this guy's eyes. Think about this scene. The guy doesn't even know it's coming, right? Somebody just starts putting stuff on your face. But he takes it. He receives it. And Jesus said to the man, verse 7, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. All right, at this point, Jesus exits stage left. And we don't see him again until the end of the story. And meanwhile, there's going to be four scenes in which all of the discussion and all of the action is centered around what happened to this man. There will be much debate. And it begins with the guy's neighbors. So whereas the disciples wanted to explain his blindness, everybody else now wants to try to explain his sight. What happened here? And so as he comes back seeing the people of the city, his neighbors, people that had passed him every day for probably decades, are now encountering this new creation, and they don't know what to do with him. What do the neighbors see? Well, it's hard to say. Look at verse 8. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar, that was their label for him, they were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" And some said, "No, it looks like him, but nah, it's not him, it can't be." They'd walk by this guy maybe every day, maybe for years or decades, some of them, and they can't figure out if it's him or not. And that's kind of crazy, right? It's not that crazy. I mean, there's probably people in your workplace, on your way home, in the coffee shop you go to, there's probably people here that you just pass by. You don't pay much attention to. We have labels. One of the reasons we don't notice people or try to move toward people is because we've labeled them in such a way that it makes us think we've already seen everything we need to see. People just don't change. He's messy, he'll always be messy. She's anxious, she'll always be anxious. He's a blind sinner, and he'll always be a blind sinner. And so when he comes back seeing, it confronts their way of seeing the world. The way that we don't notice things is actually a field of study having to do with the kind of the way our attention is diverted. In this specific case, you can read about change blindness. And so this one psychology department did an experiment where a man walks up to a stranger to get directions, and he's got a map, and he spends a decent amount of time talking to the stranger and trying to get directions, and the guy's pointing him different places, and they're looking at the map together. And after a few minutes, three guys come walking with a door, like sideways, and they're carrying it, and they intentionally walk right between these two people. And as they walk between them, the original guy who's getting directions slips up on the door, and the last guy on the door slips out with a map and keeps talking to the guy. And the majority of people they did this to never clued in that they were talking to a different person now. And the reason that happens is because we assume that the world doesn't change. We assume that how we remember it is how it actually is. And for the most part, we're right, this study would say. But the problem is that we always are operating on that assumption. Their conclusion was this. They said, only when forced to confront what we're missing do we realize that we've unwittingly made assumptions. And in some ways, that's what Jesus is doing with this blind man. He is confronting the way that you think the world is so that you might be forced to question your assumptions. People don't change. And Jesus is saying, I change people. What do you say? Another study similar to that one concluded with this statement, which I thought was insightful. He says, be careful what you choose to ignore. It might keep you from noticing something important later. And that's what happened to the neighbors. They just ignored this guy for so long. And when God came and put his works on display in him, they didn't notice it. Do you believe, I mean really, at a heart level, that God changes people? Not even just incrementally, like a really good self-help program, but radically. That the things that weigh you down and entangle you, you could actually be cut free from. And the ways in which you've labeled other people, they could, by God's grace, completely break out of that box. And if they did, would you see it and celebrate? Or would you see it as a threat to the control that you have over them with that label? Verse 10. The neighbors are deliberating, and all the while, John says, he kept saying, I am the man. Like, no, I'm the guy. So they said to him, then how were your eyes opened? I think still skeptic. He answered, the man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed and received my sight. And they said to him, well, where is he? And he says, I don't know. I just know what happened. So the facts are in now. The guy was born blind. Now he can see. All right, they've got the basic report of what happened. So now the question is, maybe more significant, it's more theological, which is, what do we do with this guy? Because before he was unclean, and now he's I don't know, clean? I'm not really sure. How do we make this decision? And so they had ways of determining this, and so they took this man to the religious leaders so that they could weigh in and tell them how they're supposed to view this man now. Look at the next verse. Verse 13. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had formerly been blind. Now, it was a Sabbath day when Jesus made the mud and opened his eyes. So the Pharisees are already aware of what happened. They've heard about the story, and they are acutely aware that it happened on a Sabbath day. And if there's anything that the Pharisees hate, it is a miracle on the Sabbath. Can't have that. Verse 15, so the Pharisees again ask him how he had received his sight. See, they're just concerned with how this thing happened because they want to figure out how do they catch Jesus in this. And he said to them, he put mud on my eyes, I washed, and I see. It's a three-stage operation. So here, the man who had been formerly blind is standing before the Pharisees. And he's told them what happened. And what do they see? The disciples have seen a theological question. The neighbors have seen something that they don't believe because they don't remember it that way. And the Pharisees see a violation of the Sabbath law. It was not lawful to work on the Sabbath. And they had all kinds of rules about what constituted work. And one of those rules was, for instance, you couldn't knead dough. And so what Jesus did by spitting in the mud and making clay would be considered like kneading dough. Which raises the question, by the way, why does Jesus do that? He doesn't have to. I think he does it to directly confront their rules. So it's not just that Jesus does the work of God. He does it in such a way that gives a frontal attack on the idols of the culture that he's in. He does this on purpose, just to make them mad. See, that's what light does. That's what John tells Nicodemus. Light comes into the world, and those who love the light come running to it. And those who don't love the light because they love the deeds of darkness resist it. So he's just stirring up controversy so that light might have its effect. You have to ask the question then, why are they so occupied on these rules? Well, the reason is because this is one of the ways they distinguish themselves. They constructed all these ways of acting that aren't necessarily God's law, but are kind of related to it. But it's really a reduced law, something they can do on their own strength so that they might be able to measure themselves, so that they can look at their obedience to the law and feel good about themselves, and at the same time, judge the unrighteous sinners who don't obey their rules. You see how when you're focused on secondary things, and you elevate them above primary things, you end up not being able to see either thing that well. You see, they've taken their rules of the Sabbath and elevated above the Lord of the Sabbath, who meanwhile is trying to demonstrate them what the Sabbath is really for. And because they've got second things ahead of first things, they don't see either accurately. They're so preoccupied with their own works that they don't see right before them the works of God on display. Some of you have probably seen a man named Apollo Robbins. He's been on a couple talk shows and there's a couple TED Talks with him in it. Apollo Robbins is a pickpocket. And instead of stealing stuff on the subway, he actually demonstrates how he does it and he uses it to teach about human attention. And so he'll have a couple, 1 to 3 people on the stage, and he's talking to them about how he's going to steal their watch, and while he's talking to them about how he's going to do that, he actually steals their watch, and they don't even see it, and he like holds it up behind them just to like mock them. And then he takes somebody's wallet, and he takes somebody's money out of their front pocket. Pretty soon, he's just got like all kinds of their stuff on him, and the whole time he's explaining how he does these things, and they don't even see it. It's pretty cool to watch. What I found really interesting is he talks about how he does this, and he says, you know, we are not as attentive as we think we are. We think that we can kind of see multiple things at once and process multiple things at once. That's why we text and drive, but we can't. And so he says, if I can divert your attention, then I can do my work elsewhere. And so he said, I think of it like a spotlight. And so they reenacted one of the things that he had done, and they put a spotlight on the person's attention, where Apollo was making the person look. And he says, so your eyes follow this spotlight, and then he says, and I do my dancing in the darkness. And so he's talking about a guy's watch. the spotlight's on the watch. And then he quickly diverts the guy's attention over here. And as he's doing that, you see his other hand come up in the darkness and take the guy's watch, and the guy never feels it. That's pretty cool. The phenomena that he's describing is called inattentional blindness, and it's defined this way. It's the failure to notice a fully visible but unexpected object or event when you're focusing attention on something else. You may have seen a classic study in this where there's a group of students. I think there's 8 to 10 students. Half of them have white shirts on or white clothes. Half of them have black clothes. And before they show you this video, they'll say, okay, I want you to count how many times the white team passes the ball to each other. And so the video comes on, and all these students are like moving in around this circle. They're passing a basketball to each other. And all of you are watching it, and I'm watching it, and I'm going to be the person who's not tricked, and I am going to get this right because I'm smart. And so I am counting how many times the white team passes the basketball. It's all I can focus on. So the video ends, and then they say, okay, how many times did they pass it? And there's all kinds of answers, and there's a right answer. And they give you the right answer, and everybody who got it feels really good about themselves. Like, yeah, see, I can know what's up. I can pay attention. And then the next question they ask is, how many of you saw the gorilla in the middle of the circle? And historically, every time they do it, half the people in the room are like, what? What are you talking about? There's no gorilla in that circle. And then they play the video again. Sure enough, as they're passing the ball back and forth, very casually, a person in a full gorilla suit just walks into the circle, faces the camera, and beats his chest like this, and then just walks out. And of course, after they told you it's there, everybody sees it because you're looking for it. We have the impression that we see the world as it is because we think we're paying attention, but we're paying attention to the wrong things. Pharisees are all entangled with these rules, and for them, this is what righteousness means. And Jesus is saying, you have missed it altogether. This is the way, or one way at least, in which the enemy works in our lives. He moves the spotlight around to secondary things. We chase it like a cat. And then he does his dancing in the darkness. And so if you sacrifice really important things like intimacy with God, relationships with people, if you sacrifice those things for secondary things like work, success, money, reputation, you have a severe case of inattentional blindness. And that's the work of the enemy in our lives. Now, not all the Pharisees were so blind. Some of them said, verse 16, how can a man who is a sinner do such signs? This is a good question. Okay, wait. He couldn't see. Now he can see. I'm not going to just rush to judgment here. And so there was a division, John says, among them. And so they go back to the blind man. Notice he's still referred to as the blind man, even though he can see, because that's the label they've got for him. They go back to the blind man and they ask him, verse 17, what do you say about him since he has opened your eyes? And the blind man says, he is a prophet. So they've confirmed that, or they've confirmed at least that the guy has seen. But there's still the question of like, is this really the real guy? And so they call in the guy's parents. And they say, hey, what do you say? Is this your son who was born blind from death? And the parents don't have much to say. They say, yes, we know that he is our son. We know that he was blind from birth. We know that he can see now. But how this happened, we don't know. He's of age. Ask him. He can tell you. He's a big boy. Why are they so hesitant here? What do they see? Well, the parents, I think, see a threat to their way of life. The word is out on the street that if anyone confesses that Jesus is the Christ, then they will be put out of the synagogue, which is kind of the center of life for them. And so they're thinking, look, if we get excited about this healing and possibly give off the impression that we're excited about Jesus, then that's going to have political, economic, social, religious ramifications for us. And so they think it's best just to keep their thoughts about Jesus private. You know, there's political stuff, there's business stuff, there's leisure stuff, there's friend stuff, and there's Jesus stuff. And their decision is to not mix the Jesus stuff in with all the other stuff. And in making that decision, they kind of throw their son under the bus. And we think it's cold-hearted, but that kind of wisdom to kind of keep things compartmentalized, well, that's standard wisdom in our culture. So here are some signs of blindness. If you don't take risks for the cause of Christ, if you don't just tell the truth about yourself, about God, because you fear rejection or conflict, you've got the blindness of the parents working in you. If you don't openly celebrate what you see God doing around you, you probably suffer from the blindness of the parents. So the Pharisees' first line of attack is that he was not the same man. That's been disproven, so now they get personal. And as Todd said last week, that's how you know you've lost the debate, when you start making it personal. Verse 24, they call the man back in, and they said to him, "Give glory to God." In other words, stop lying. We know that this man is a sinner. And the blind man answered, "Whether he's a sinner, I don't know. Here's one thing I do know. I was blind, and now I see." It's incontrovertible testimony. There's nothing they can say about it. And so they get back to the issue of Sabbath. Verse 26, they said to him, "Okay, tell us again. What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" It's just crazy. Like, listen to yourself. "I was blind, and now I can see. What does it matter how he did it?" He answered them, "I've told you already, and you would not listen. Why do you want to hear it again?" And he starts to get a little snarky. He says, "Is it possible that you want to be his disciples too?" And they are outraged. They say to him, "You are his disciple. We are the disciples of Moses." Always distinguishing themselves, always creating classes of people. "We know that God has spoken to Moses, but as for this man, Jesus, we don't know where he comes from." And the man says, "Oh, this is an amazing thing." You see, the blind man is amazed, not at his sight, but at their blindness. He thought that he was blind and that everybody out there could see. And now that he can see, he realizes that everyone out there is actually blind. Throughout the conversation, the Pharisees say, "We know, we know." And this is their mantra, "We know." And the man is just lovingly and hilariously pointing out the irony. He says, in essence, "Man, for people who know so much, you sure are asking me a lot of questions." This is where it gets personal. They say, "You were born in utter sin, and you would teach us?" All right, so here's another sign of blindness. This is the Pharisees' blindness, and it is simply that you're always right in your own eyes. In other words, you're not very teachable, and further, you really only think you have something to learn from, and you really only want to be around people who are like you and who see the world like you. You create classes in your mind, and you think, "I can learn from the people in my class and above, whatever the scale is, and I only have things to teach everybody else." That kind of blindness inevitably condemns people. Inevitably, it isolates people. And that's what we see with the Pharisees. Their verdict in verse 34, they cast him out. The blind man, the beggar, the sinner, who nobody wanted to see, is finally out of sight. At this point, you could ask the neighbors and the parents and certainly the Pharisees, how many times did the white team pass the ball? Like, how many questions you ask him, and what were the details of how he received his sight? And they could probably recount it all for you and feel good about themselves and their verdict. And then you could ask them, "But did you see the gorilla in the middle of the circle? Like, did you see that there was a man who was blind from birth and could see?" And they would say, "What are you talking about?" You would say, "The works of God were on display right before you." And they'd say, "No." This man who was blind is cast out. Nobody hugs him. You know, he receives his sight. Nobody, like, throws a party. Nobody asks him how it feels to see. Nobody apologizes for neglecting him all those times. Just the opposite. They're threatened by him, and they exclude him. At least before, I think the guy might be thinking, he was in the mix. I mean, he was blind and he was begging for money, but he was around the temple. But now, maybe he feels more isolated in his faith than he did when he was blind. I think some of you may have that experience. You're on the other side of this thing. You're not excluding people. You're the one that feels excluded. Your faith in Christ has caused others to move away from you. The change that God is doing in your life has caused others to sort of resist you in some way. And the good news is that Jesus sees you. That's like to the bookend of the whole story. It begins with Jesus seeing the man. Now, look in verse 35. Jesus heard that they had cast him out, and having found him, Jesus hears that the man has been cast out and goes looking for him. And in chapter 10, we're going to see that Jesus is the good shepherd that goes and finds the lost sheep. And he says to the man, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" And the blind man who can now see answered, "And who is he, sir, that I may believe in him?" So he knows what Jesus has done and meant in his life, and he's going to do whatever Jesus says. So whoever Jesus says the Son of Man is, whoever that is, I'm going to believe in him. And Jesus said, "You've already seen him, and he's the one speaking to you right now." And so the man believed. He said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshiped him. Much like we saw in John 4, where there's this sort of escalating understanding of who Jesus is with the woman at the well, in John 9, there is an increasing light about who Jesus is. In his first trip to the witness stand, they ask him who did it, and he refers to him, he says, "The man called Jesus." Just the man named Jesus. Then later they ask him, "What do you say about him?" He says, "I think he's a prophet." And then he defends Jesus at great cost to himself, at great risk. And then he's cast out for it, and he worships Jesus. This is why Jesus came into the world, because he's seeking worshipers. And it doesn't always happen all at once. And I want to affirm in your lives, as I've seen God at work in your life, it happens kind of progressively. There is a work of God on display, but it's a work in progress. We have increasing understanding of who Jesus is, increasing understanding of what's going on in our own souls, and an increasing sense of gratefulness and worship to God. I think that's how God works. Jesus sees what everyone else misses, the person created in the image of God, marred and corrupted by sin, cast out by people, but the perfect backdrop for the redemptive work of God to be displayed. One question we have to ask ourselves in closing as we read this text is, do I see the world that way? Through the lens of God's story, has the light so shone on me that I can see as Jesus sees? When I look at myself, am I looking at my own works and feeling either acceptable or unacceptable to God? When I come up to the darkness and the broken parts of other people, do I see an opportunity for God's work to be put on display and then move into that work as a fellow worker with Christ? You might ask the question, well, but how can I see if I'm blind to it? This is essentially the question the Pharisees ask at the end of the chapter. They ask it sarcastically, but they're closer to the truth than they know. How can I see if I'm blind? Well, we're all spiritually blind, and that's why Jesus says, "I'm the light of the world." He says, "I came to make things very clear so that those who see the light and believe will know that I'm the Son of God and will see the world the way I see it, and that those who love their deeds of darkness would resist. And that's, so I came both to bring life and to bring judgment." And his light shines most brightly when things get the darkest. At the beginning of the story, he tells the disciples, "We must do the works of God who sent me, because the night is coming. The night is coming. What's he saying? He's saying, while I'm here physically, I am the light of the world and I will do works of light. But the night is coming. There is going to be a dark hour. And when Jesus is lifted up on the cross, you read the accounts, the world went dark, literally, in the middle of the day. It was dark physically, it was dark spiritually. What Jesus is telling us is, I'm going to go into the darkness and suffer so that you can come into the light and be healed. And anyone who looks at Jesus hung on the cross, risen from the dead, and sees there the light of the world will be saved and will see the world as he sees it. And anyone who looks at Jesus and thinks that it doesn't have much to do with them, they walk in a terrible darkness. They're so preoccupied with their own works that they are seeking the praise of men while the true worshipers are praising God right in front of them. Let's pray that we would be true worshipers.
Thanks for listening to the podcast of Providence Church. For more resources and info, visit us online at www.providenceaustin.com.